If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at TNTradio.live. No propaganda, no lies, and definitely no BS. You're with George Eliason, live from Donbas, Ukraine, on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
It's hump day. Welcome to the midweek show. Today we've got Dr. Sal Giorgiani and talking to us, and he's an expert in men's health, is a senior science advisor to the Men's Health Network. Now, Dr. Giorgiani had a 26-year career with Pfizer, and where he held positions in the medical, regulatory, training, public policy, business planning, sales, and marketing groups. Most recently, he served as Pfizer's Director of External Relations. He also directed several publications, including the Pfizer's Career in Healthcare series and the Pfizer Journal Perspectives in Healthcare and Biomedical Research. He is a recognized expert in drug regulatory and U.S. pharmaceutical policy. He's also a founding member of the Dialogue on Men's Health and a presenter at the White House Conference on Men's Health. Dr. Giorgiani, welcome. Thanks for coming on today.
Well, good. Thank you very much for having me on today, George.
We're talking a lot about COVID, the flu, and everything. Now, I want to take a long perspective on this. 20 years from now, when people look back, what are they going to say about the COVID era? What do you think?
You know, I am in my 70s now, so I hope I'd be around to understand that. But I think that they're going to be looking at a very unique experience, and not necessarily a model experience about how to handle a pandemic. One of the things that makes this unique, George, is the function of the internet and the role of the internet, social media, and not only an eye onto what was happening, but also an influencer of what is happening. If you look back at all the pandemics and going back to the last true global pandemic, HIV, AIDS, or even if you want to go back to respiratory pandemics, the Spanish flu in the 1918, 1919, there was no influence of social media, certainly not to this point. The other is that I believe that what's going to be unique in the perspective on this whole scenario is the whole issue of how political influences on science played out in either a positive or a negative way. And as with many complex sorts of scenarios, I don't think it was all positive or all negative. I know some people are very much moaning or bemoaning the fact that things didn't quite go so well and governments intervened, but I do think there were some possible positives. I do a lot of work now. I have my work at Pfizer. I still stay active as a men's health advocate, and I work for the Men's Health Network as a science advisor and a vice president for another organization called Healthy Men, Inc., which is a non-for-profit that looks at the health of men and boys. And I think some of the unique perspectives we gained on how boys and men react to both the scenario of the pandemic, the information, and also very important things about masking, death rates, and that's very important and part of the perspective we have to look at as well.
Well, what do you think, what's the most negative aspect that you can talk about that came out of this? What was the actual worst possible thing?
The communications part. I believe in talking with other clinicians, other scientists, other observers of how health is laid out. The communications was very unclear. It was contradictory. It was off the top of the cuff in all too many circumstances. And it was soundbite oriented as opposed to information oriented. At no point in history have we ever seen information being put out by a government about a disease state the way we saw it with COVID, and as we're seeing it play out with other things now, that government would be working along with information providers and packagers, such as social media, electronic media, written media, to help very forcefully direct the nature of the dialogue. We saw a little bit of that in the polio outbreaks in the 1950s, where I was just a young guy with long brown curly hair, but so I don't really remember. But looking back at some of the reports, yes, there was some collaboration, if you will, between government trying to get polio vaccines into the arms of all that they possibly could, or mouth, you know, when we got to the oral doses. But it was a very positive, very different communication path than it was than what we saw in the past 3 years. So I think communications is something that will have experts on information noodling over for a very long time to come.
Why don't you think they could get a handle on that? I mean, you know, I agree with you on that. It's just, you know, it's atrocious. We're talking about the government. Why couldn't they get a handle on something as basic as communication?
Well, I think they did get a handle on it, but they communicated in the way that government likes to communicate about these things, in a very controlling thou shalt do or thou shalt be punished way. So the way a clinician communicates with a patient, whether you're a physician, pharmacist, nurse, dentist, or healthcare provider in any other way, is we try to provide information for the patient so the patient can make their own decision with guidance and suggestions and recommendations by the clinician. But a fundamental aspect of that, George, is that the patient is in charge of their own autonomy. They are responsible for their own healthcare decision making. And our job, really, and most of us look at it that way, is not to dictate, but to advocate and then persuade. The government doesn't quite take that approach. It doesn't take that approach in revenue generation for the government. It's you shall or you will be punished. Right. It doesn't really, it's a completely different mindset. So one of the things that I think needs to be reflected on is in the States, and I know you go globally to many countries where healthcare is funded by the central government. One of the things we have to consider is how the scenario that played out in COVID might translate into a broader initiative for centralized government-funded healthcare in the United States. I think that's something we have to think also about, and historians 20 years from now will also be looking at that. And again, I think the unique factor here is the awesome, I think, impact that social electronic media has had that makes virtually everybody hear the messages in a very controllable way.
Well, the messaging that they did was just so mixed. When COVID first broke out, the big outbreaks in the U.S., I mean, it was, the messaging was essentially, this is the, rebirth of the Spanish flu, or this is the Black Death, more or less, and you need to do this. And,
shock and awe, doom and gloom.
And, okay, now you lost me because it's not happening. It's not what you're saying it is.
That's another important point here, George. Sorry about the delay in the back and forth here, but
go ahead.
This is one of the few times that the public has gotten a peek into the type of discourse that health professionals engage in and scientists engage in all the time. There's a lot of, I used to teach at Columbia University and Belmont University. And one of the things I would tell my doctoral students is that getting a doctoral degree prepares you to have the privilege of being told that you're stupid, you don't know what you're talking about, and have to be able to defend every moment of the time at a podium or at a presentation or in your clinical work, your decisions, in a very rough and tumble way, if you will. And right. I think that's what we saw here, is that the discourse, the dialogue going back and forth between scientists and clinicians in a very uncertain scenario in the early parts of 2020 played out in front of the public, where we are, you know, as learned intermediaries, and that's the principal role the folks in the white coats have in healthcare, is a learned intermediary to help people understand the information and make their own decisions. We saw that dialogue, that debate, that ever-shifting landscape of data and understanding shift literally month to month to month. We see that with so many medical conditions, diabetes. We're still debating the best way to treat diabetes, but that's back in camera, behind the curtain. We are still debating whether something as simple, one would think, of taking a low-dose aspirin tablet is a good thing. We're still debating whether screening for breast cancer, testicular cancer, mental illness is a good thing and a useful thing and cost-effective thing. So we have these debates in camera behind the curtain all the time. But this COVID, again, I believe because of two things, the politicization of this terrible, terrible condition by governments globally, and the influence of social media with a 24/7, almost instantaneous time frame of looking at the debate. So, and the public becomes very confused. Heck, I got very confused. I had lots and lots of questions every time a shift in the data was presented. So as a consumer of the information that comes out of government, myself and the other folks who are in the profession, health professions, are consumers of that information. We get our data from our federal sources or global sources, CDC, WHO, county and state health departments. As that data kept shifting and as their views, we're used to dealing with the uncertainties of what that all means in the real world. But the general public is befuddled by that, confused by that, and that led to a lot of, I think, anger and some of the vaccine hostility that we see now. We move from vaccine hesitancy to vaccine hostility, which is having a dramatic impact on vaccinations for all sorts of conditions, including childhood conditions. And we see it even now with flu 2022 flu season. It's having a dramatic impact on uptake of vaccines for flu. So I think that is a very important sort of perspective to take a look at, the confused nature of this debate played out in public and became grist for the clickbait media.
Well, I'm kind of breaking off on that. I'm going to get back into the 2022 flu season in a second, and the media. Social yeah. media and alternative news that has come out about this. At the end of this, what do you think Anthony Fauci's legacy is going to be? Mm-hmm. Good guy, bad guy, pariah, prescient, what?
Well, to which audience? I think in certain well, it's true, you know, you're a communications guy, and the same message going out to broadly diverse audiences can be received and viewed in a very different way. And that's very important as well. I think in the public health, in the core public health community, and I'm also a co-founder of the American Public Health Association section on men's health. I've done a lot of work in men with some wonderful public health folks. But I think by and large, the public health community is going to view his work as laudable. He fought the good fight. There were mistakes made, but there are a lot of good things that came out of it. And there was, and he utilized many of the tools that are utilized in population health, which is basically population influencing and control and management to the point of, some would say, manipulation. He used those tools available to him, and he did it in a very odd, and some will view, and many will view it in a hostile political environment. Then you look at the healthcare professionals who are perhaps a bit more understanding of it. We all understand that in the first several months of what happened, that Fauci played a very important role in giving advice, Fauci and Bricks and the other senior people at CDC, NIH, and globally, gave a very important perspective to the political leaders and also the healthcare professional leadership. So that was, I think, in the beginning, what they did was reasonable, even though many people would argue with me about that. But then where I think that the health professions will deviate a bit was when the certainty, or when the data became clearer and clearer and clearer, and the kaleidoscope of what we're looking at became more crystallized and showed a pattern, which is sometimes the best you can do in healthcare. The dialogue, the perspectives, the mandates, if you will, or the dictates, I think is a better word maybe, the dictates from the public health community at the federal level, and then trickling down to the state and local levels, did not change quickly enough or well enough. So I think the average clinician feels that there were lots of problems later on with sticking to your point and not mentioning or not agreeing that mistakes were made and we need to recalibrate. So even now, we're still looking at that kind of mentality in some parts of the states, and I think globally. And when you look at the general public, they, I think, looked at it as a complete disaster. The media, I think, looked at it as a great opportunity to tell stories and satisfy the urging for information that is the mainstay of the contemporary electronic and even print, which really is really electronic media. But the general public, Joe and Jane, just are completely disgusted by the whole thing. I think by and large, even those who are, I would say, diehard, keep the masks on camp and be vaccinated. If you want, I can talk about my personal views on that, what I advise people about. They I think, still feel that the communications was bad and Fauci's role may have been a little bit overplayed. We will see, and I think we'll see very soon how history will judge Fauci, Bricks, and others in that milieu, Redfield, how their view, what people's view will be. We'll know that in a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. All right, we've got to take a quick break. I want to pick it up there when we come back. Today we've got Dr. Salvador Giorgiani with us, and we're discussing COVID vaccines, mandates, and policy. We'll see you in a few minutes.
You should hear what Lynn Shaw is talking about.
Children today are the currency. They're eyeballs online for marketers. They're information. Today, children are the product, and they're being attacked on every front. Although there are a lot of organizations, nonprofits, a lot of good people, and in the government, and we're working so hard on laws and legislation, in the meantime, you cannot sit back. It's 2022, almost 2023. You have to step up. You have to protect your vulnerable children and grandchildren, and you all have to participate. The days of doing nothing, dropping the kids at school or on the school bus, and then that's it for 6 or 8 hours, over. Over, because we have a complicit, I dare say, I'll go for it, government. definitely complicit media, complicit Hollywood, and our schools and medical community seem to be riding this wave of child exploitation. They want a lot of gender talk, but they do not want to talk about internet safety, something that is surrounding all of us because we all live now in this digital world, and that's okay, but let's leverage it for good.
Lynn Shaw and Lynn's Warriors on TNT Radio.
The mission of Paralyzed Veterans of America is clear. Accessibility. Veterans who have served and sacrificed the best of themselves deserve access to the best our country has to offer. Access to meaningful employment. Access to the veterans' benefits they've earned. Accessible homes and vehicles. And access to every part of their communities. With PVA staff working inside VA hospitals, no other veterans organization has provided more real-time, ongoing support for paralyzed veterans and their families. PVA is proud to serve veterans across all branches, all generations, and all conflicts. Our nation's heroes fought for your independence. Join PVA in fighting for theirs at pva.org.
Today's News Talk Radio.
Come on, let the man talk.
We never censor our hosts.
Good. Now, talk.
Uncensored news.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back. We're with Dr. Sal Giorgiani. We're discussing COVID, policy, Fauci, and all things flu today. Dr. Giorgiani, what's your take? What's your take on the 2022 flu season? Where are we at? You started saying that people were balking at vaccinations.
Yeah, this is a very important aspect of this because it goes back to what we were originally talking about, how history will view what happened with COVID and what were some of the negative aspects of how the situation was managed. When COVID hit, I think just about everybody was happy, although that happiness may not be a well-placed thing, that seasonal flu, influenza, H1N2 flu was small, very few cases reported, very light season in the general public's eye, not anything to worry about. So I think, unfortunately, what then happened is that many, many folks did not get vaccinated for flu in 2020, near the end of the flu season in the Northern Hemisphere, during 2021. There was an awful lot of discussion about COVID. And around that time, people were becoming very vaccine hesitant. So vaccination rates, as I mentioned, for many, many things, childhood conditions, shingles, hepatitis, you go up and down the list of vaccinatable conditions, vaccinations were all down. Same for flu. The other thing that happened is that during that period where people were masking, sanitizing their hands, keeping distance, being very cognizant of the environment around them and how they behave, you didn't see Joe going into work and coughing on the phone or Mary going into work and, you know, sneezing around the office. You didn't see folks in the supermarkets, gas stations, coughing or sneezing onto touch pads. People were very, very careful with many ways. So what happened then is we saw that there was a public expectation that flu may not be the really big problem now. But now in 2022, and here's where we go back and we look at what happens in the Southern Hemisphere, Australia, Latin America, Africa, where flu season begins much earlier in the year, along around February, and it ends along around July or so. And then we look at what happened there. People still did not go back in to get flu vaccinations at the same rate and pace that they were before. The immunologic baseline of individuals for having had essentially 2 years of no flu vaccinations, started to go down. So that people didn't have the inherent immunity that they had in 2019 across the board. And we saw, at least in Australia, where I've been following the data, and also in Chile, the what was characterized as the worst flu season since 2017. It started earlier, down in the Southern Hemisphere, and it's very hard to track this because unlike COVID, you don't have all this massive impetus to track individual data at the public health level, and folks just don't test for flu, really. So really, we really don't know the magnitude of it. But we did see in hospitalizations, severity of disease based on clinical visits and in charts and the billing data, that it was a much earlier start and a much tougher season than has been seen since 2017. Now in the States, where in the Northern Hemisphere, where we're just getting into flu season, I think we're about a month and a half into it at this point, maybe 2 months, we are unfortunately seeing the pattern in the Southern Hemisphere repeat, both in terms of flu vaccination hesitancy, overall views about flu about vaccine hostility, skepticism. People don't want to hear the information coming out of the CDC, which is the principal demographic and collection source for all of this health information in the States and analogous organizations in United Kingdom, around the globe. They don't want to hear it. They look at the data with a jaundiced eye, if you will. So what we're seeing, unfortunately, is a quick rise in flu, coupled along with RVS, which generally affects just young children under two and older individuals, which is another respiratory infection, and also the remnants of the COVID vaccine. So we do have three respiratory conditions tracking. And what concerns many of us is that people are just not going in to pharmacies, to their general practitioners for flu shots. They're sort of written off the flu for a myriad of reasons. And I think may also be a historical perspective on how the handling of the COVID information and vaccination campaigns will impact information and vaccination campaigns for many, many conditions, even the seasonal flu, moving forward.
Well, here's a question. Now, I'm 56, and in my lifetime, no one's ever asked me to wear a surgical mask during flu season. We're looking at essentially the same thing. Now, with the lockdowns, with the quarantines, with the masking, was this bad policy all the way around? And that, you know, the mandatory, you get a vaccine or, you know, don't work at all, stay home. What was the real impetus for this?
Yes, well.
Do you see what I'm asking? You're looking at the flu, and we're looking at COVID-19, which is a flu.
Yep. I understand pretty well, I hope. I believe, if not, you can correct me as I go along, that we have had in the States, and that's where my professional experience is greatest, but I also understand there are other areas of the world where it's similar. We have had vaccine mandates for influenza vaccine for many years in the States. Most folks don't understand that or don't know that. But for healthcare professionals and certain individuals in high susceptible areas where there's contact with potentially immunologically compromised or elderly individuals, there have been vaccine mandates in place for flu for many, many, many years. Hospitals, it started, I would think, I'm sort of estimating here, if you will, guesstimating, about 10 years before, where hospitals, healthcare facilities, pharmacies, et cetera, position, they were requiring flu vaccine of employees, or they would, these employees would be removed from patient care areas, or they would be required to wear masks. So a little bit of what you saw playing out with COVID is based on that historical trend, which is based on, I think, a mix of intuition and data, not completely data-driven. And face it, we often forget the saying that there's an art and science to medicine and healthcare practices. Everybody, I think, is under the misnomer, it's all science. But no, it's art and science. There's intuition, there's experience. So we saw that play out in, for vaccine mandates in the workplace for flu. And now people are not very happy about that coming back, but it is back. So I think we are seeing some mandates, but there's been a lot of pushback by organized labor.
Well, that's not the medical profession. That's, you know, in terms of, you know, doctors, nurses, medical professionals that are treating a wide gamut of patients and large numbers of patients, you know, okay, I can see why you'd have the mandate for the vaccine. But we're talking about the general public, and I've never seen this done before. That was the nature of the question.
Yeah, okay. Sorry if I misunderstood. Yeah, for the general public, there were no vaccine mandates, although I will say that I did work at a Department of Defense clinical area for TRICARE for Life, and I was required as a condition of employment there to get vaccinated as if I were mobilizing to Southeast Asia. So I got had to get vaccinated. So, you know, there are pockets even in the private sector where these mandates for flu vaccine, hepatitis, tuberculin testing, you know, were required. But for the general public, no. Because in the democratic parts of the world, generally speaking, governments did not have the authority or the power under normal conditions to mandate anything. What happened, though, is once a public health emergency was declared, and this is one of the concerns I have moving forward, that the public health emergency for COVID in the United States has been reauthorized. Every few months, it has to be recertified by the federal government. But the public health emergency continues on in the U.S. But once you issue a public health emergency status, and it varies in different.
It's still ongoing right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's been reauthorized, I believe, up until next June, which I think is pretty interesting. Or maybe July, January. I really don't remember the date. Sorry. But, you know, it's they reauthorize it. This allows governments to do a lot of things, some of them I think very helpful, such as early development, release, and promotion of medicines and vaccinations. Don't forget, all the COVID vaccines were initially released under an emergency use authorization. And still we have many of the treatments, Paxlovid and even the EvuShield product in the U.S. that is useful in individuals who can't or won't be vaccinated for COVID. EvuShield is under these emergency use authorizations, which allows the federal government to control product marketing, product distribution, product communications. It also allows the governments to do certain things about public health emergencies. And in different parts of the country, state public health departments are also continuing on their pandemic emergencies. So,
well, while with everything they know now,
yes,
with everything they know now, with all the data they've had 2 years worth of data, plus everything before that, studying this virus, what's justifying having that state of emergency right now? It's doesn't the data say this should have been stopped, ended a long time ago after we got a handle on this? Or what am I missing with that?
Oh, you're not missing anything, Georgia. You have to ask that question to the government officials who make that decision. I will tell you, because I do a lot of work in the patient advocacy arena, there are some patient groups, organized patient groups in the states, who are very happy that the public health emergency is continuing on. And they're urging government to continue it on because they feel this is the best way to control the actions of the public. The actions of the public. We sometimes confuse population health manipulation to clinical care. They're not the same thing. Population health, which is mostly manipulative and socially engineered approaches to getting people to think about something, is very different than the way clinicians think, which is patient-focused driven. So, yeah, mm-hmm. You have to ask that question. I think that it should have been dropped several months ago. I'm reluctant to put a date on it because I'd have to go and give it more thought. But I do think it's being dragged on because once governments get power, authority, and control, it's very, very difficult to pull that back. And I think that's natural tendency of government and the way government manages things, where bureaucrats manage things. I think that's what we're seeing. It's never been, and you're absolutely correct again, George, we've never seen that in this country. And the extreme example is what we're seeing continuing on in China, where the management, the social management and tracking of people in the general population is at the extreme level. And that's one of the things that concerns many, many individuals here. So
Fauci got his inspiration from that.
It might have been the other way around. It might have been the other way around. The U.S. public health community is amongst the best respected, most organized of groups. But I give a moment of grace in the first 6 months or 8 months of the pandemic before we actually had any vaccines and things of that nature back. Because remember, December 2020 was when we started having vaccines available. It wasn't available, right at the start. And it was limited and it was a scramble to get it. I think that the developing countries and WHO, who acts as a surrogate public health department for the developing countries, the developing worlds, and they took their clue from the very organized 160-plus-year-old, maybe 175, I don't know, U.S. American Public Health Association and its membership. So that's where the driving force is.
I want to read something briefly, and this is from NPR, of all places, National Public Radio, September 2022. Now, they were doing an interview with Dr. Shira Doran. She's an infectious disease specialist at Tufts Medical Center, professor at Tufts University. She's talking about COVID deaths. Now, if the deaths were classified more accurately, then a daily death toll would be closer to the toll the flu takes during a typical season, Doran said. Now, if this is true, the odds of a person dying if they get a COVID infection, what's called the case fatality rate, would be about the same as the flu now, which is estimated to be around 0.1% or perhaps even lower. And Fauci argues that it's difficult to distinguish between deaths that are caused because of COVID and those who have or with COVID. Disease has been found to put stress on many systems of the body. What's the difference with someone who has a mild congestive heart failure and goes into the hospital and gets COVID, then dies from profound congestive heart failure? Yes, is that with COVID or because of COVID? COVID certainly contributed to it. And they're saying that 70% of the hospitalizations mm-hmm. are the deaths from that are being counted differently. If the patient has COVID or catches COVID, it's attributed to COVID versus, the flu, where they attribute it to congestive heart failure instead of the flu. This reckoning, and I mean, as I said, NPR, what they're saying is if the death rate, the mortality rate is as the flu is, why are we where we are right now? We're not talking about, you know, Alex Jones here.
The perspective you put on the table here, George, is a very important one, right? And I actually did do the math based on the flu 22 season and it's very difficult. You really can't measure case reports or identified cases of flu the way we were able to early on with the pandemic, and no longer because of home testing, because we had a very good handle on the number of cases on a day-to-day basis, and the data was being reported, even though it was a little messy, and then the deaths associated with were being tracked back. But yeah, right now, the numbers predict or project an image of deaths associated with COVID of less than 1%, the same in flu, less than 1%, or about 1% of cases identified end up with mortality, and it is associated with flu. So, for example, we know that one of the things that drove death or mortality with COVID were other medical conditions concomitant, or conditions that go along with the principal concern, in this case, COVID. And that is the case with many, many death certificates. What was the actual cause versus the associated causes? It's never been clear. And that's one of the things, again, you know, folks with white coats on have to take into consideration when they look at the causes of deaths listed on death certificates or in actuarial data or demographic data. So yes, it's very difficult to tease out how much COVID itself
caused. But that seemed to be skewing it a lot higher. You know, yes. A common flu strain.
Well, sure.
Because you know, that's the point NPR is making.
There were incentives to do that, to skew it a little higher, because there was monies available under emergency use allocations for the public health emergency in areas of high need. So there was, some say, a deliberate incentive to always put COVID near the top of the list of contributory causes to hospitalizations and death. So you get a few more dollars. And I think former President Trump was skewered for that mercilessly, which I'd like to get skewered for this mercilessly, when he said, yeah, there was a reason that it was being reported that way. But that was then, this is now. Those monies are not around that I know of. But you're right. The death rate, the mortality rate associated with COVID very much now is being paralleled by the 2022 flu season in terms of death rates of less than 1% or around 1%. And many people don't realize that flu is the same sort of things that predispose individuals to higher rates of mortality from COVID and other respiratory conditions are also the same things that predispose higher mortality for flu. So, for example, a good example is, since you brought up heart, individuals who have a heart condition have a significantly more, three times more risk of having a heart attack or another heart condition pop up within 6 months, or 6 weeks, I should say, of getting the respiratory flu. So that's just that's something we look at demographically. If you have a heart condition and you get a flu, you have a much higher risk of having a secondary heart event, or adverse heart event, heart attack. Same for individuals with diabetes, much more difficult to clear the infection. You're much more susceptible to the secondary effects of flu. So you can go on and on up and down the list, but I think the point here is that the data is very difficult to interpret. The numbers can be very easily misrepresented in a storyline. You're right that look at the number one killers now of men in the United States. It's not COVID, although I will say that the death rates for COVID in men was always higher globally than in women, because men are more susceptible to it and generally speaking have more comorbidity factors 56% of the deaths from COVID were in men. That's just data. But when you look at all of this now, we're seeing the same sorts of trends. The death rates in suicide in men is unfortunate, dramatic, and on a population base, almost equivalent to that of COVID at this point. The death rates from cancers, from diabetes, from other heart conditions, cardiovascular condition, now is very close to the death rate in COVID. Yet we don't see the same emphasis being placed on prevention and management with these, or the same level of public concern about, oh, I just have a little bit of a sugar problem. So I think we have to get back to the basics of risk evaluations, risk modeling, and then communicate to patients that COVID is still with us and it's going to be with us forever, just like flu is with us forever. COVID is going to be with us. And but we have to get on with managing all of the medical conditions, including the underlying conditions that predispose men and women to higher mortality from these respiratory infections.
Now, you know, what you said earlier about it, you know, as a means of, you know, government control of the population, you know, I think, you know, in this case especially, if the numbers are saying, you know, this is that, and, you know, and it's an equal value, why aren't we, you know, it's, is it the swine flu, or is it the, I don't know. We'll say the Boston Common flu. You know, why even cut the difference and just call a flu and say, look, you know, you have a vaccine, it's a flu year, get your vaccine. And we're still making the big, it's still about money, isn't it? And control.
Well, I think for the government perspective, it's certainly about control for those involved in medical product development and marketing. You know that area well. Yes, there's profitability to that, but no more so than in general medicine, where physicians, clinicians also are remunerated for their services, and they should be. So we have, that's a whole big debate, which we could take another 3 or 4 hours, maybe 3 or 4 days,
right,
debating back and forth. But I think the reality is that from the general public, all of these respiratory infections, including quote unquote the common cold, which who the heck knows what that is anymore, to respiratory syncytial virus in children and older adults, they all fall into a very big category of flu. Just like I've got a stomach ache, whether it's due to E. pylori or tainted food or you know, too much hot chili peppers in your diet, I got a stomach ache. You know, so the imprecision of language in the common vocabulary is one of the things that makes it very difficult for clinicians to talk with patients and get them to understand the management of bacterial infection, for example, versus a viral infection in the lungs. So again, you know, I think we have to get back to a mindset the way medicine was practiced in the good old days about 40
right.
years ago.
Oh, I agree.
Where a patient had a conversation with their clinician, their doctor, nurse, pharmacist, their orthopedist, who knows, dentist, about a healthcare concern or condition. It was discussed, the role of the learned intermediary with the white coat is to help patients understand the data based on their community and their individual medical conditions and background and their preferences. Look, we still have the right as individuals to deny treatment for cancer. The
right.
clinician's job is to inform and try to persuade, but it's still the patient's right to deny getting cancer treatments. So I think we have to get back to that mindset where, and what's troubling me, a point you raised earlier, or just how the control over what patients are told by their clinicians, what clinicians can express publicly, is also, I think, a very ominous sign of one of the concerns that we see now because of social media and influence of government over dialogue, that has been constrained. And many clinicians have lost their licenses, lost their jobs because
right.
they portrayed opinions about COVID that were not with the current orthodoxy, if you will. But, you know, back in 2017, 2018, 2019, 18-19, that was a discussion that was had between a clinician and a patient in confidence, where the overriding decision maker was the patient based on informed consent and joint decision-making, shared decision-making. So I think we have to get back to that notion. We will all be better off for it, I believe. It'll be less confusing for patients, and I think it'll ultimately deliver better overall care.
Now, I have a last question for you, and it is a very difficult one.
Good. I like the others. Okay.
No, this is the hard one. Okay. There was a Zoom conference with the Israeli Ministry of Health, and in the conference, they were informed by their own hand-selected outside expert group, and it was headed by a professor, Maddie Berkowitz, and they were studying whether COVID vaccines were safe or not. And, you know, as if they were as safe as the Ministry of Health had been claiming for the Israeli people. Now, the CDC kind of rested on this study. Well, from before that point, 98% of the Israelis' population took the vaccine. After this, 2%. And what they found out was that, you know, instead of being safe, it was the opposite. Instead of mild short-term events, the events were serious, long-lasting, for neurological side effects in 65% of the cases. They didn't go away at all, and researchers admitted they had no clue if they ever would go away. So we're looking at problems post-vaccine that were happening and are happening. How this was squashed, but here's the thing. Shouldn't authorities be taking the lead in discussions like this instead of it coming out in leaked Zoom conversations?
Well, this is not as difficult as you might have thought, George. But okay, good. So here we talked a lot about the dialogue and debate that goes on in camera behind the curtains amongst the folks with the white coats, if you will. I can't think of a better way to say it, but that's the way I said it.
Right.
And what goes out plays in public. So yeah, the medical communities, science communities always has these debates about what does the data show? And data at this stage in COVID and vaccines is what I would categorize as complicated or dirty data. There's no clear-cut data. Everybody reports it in different ways. The background information on the individuals is not particularly well collected. So what I think we're seeing also, as we now know, while the hope, the sincere hope of the individuals developing these vaccines was that it would blunt spread, dramatically cut down on spread, what it really ended up doing, which is a blessing, you know, it's a very important thing, is blunt the deaths and level of illness in individuals, which is very important. Otherwise, I think we would have. So, yeah, it didn't stop the spread. That was a hope. It was aspirational. It didn't play out. But then you have individuals who have been vaccinated, 80% of the population in some areas, including particularly Israel, if not more, have been vaccinated. So, of course, if you have 100 people and 80 of them have been vaccinated and 20 of them have not been vaccinated, and you have the occurrence of a side effect or long COVID present in 2-3% of the population, 2-3% of 80 is more than 2-3% of 20. So you're going to have more people right. having these symptoms or problems or reports and the clinical reports just because the population, you're not looking at a 50-50 mix of populations, which is what you try to do under controlled clinical experiment. So population data is very complex, rather dirty, and it takes several years and several slices of the data to play it out. So I do not think that that COVID vaccine caused as many problems as people were concerned about. I've been vaccinated and boosted. And we're getting our next booster. But we still got COVID. My wife and I were traveling, and we got COVID. But it was very mild. Mm-hmm. We were just inconvenienced rather than dead. We were overseas. And I think that that scenario would be great. So did we have secondary effects? Yeah, my wife had some secondary effects, some long COVID effects from that bout of COVID. But she was vaccinated. So did the vaccine cause all that? Or did getting a mild case of COVID cause all that? Well, in a population sense, we have to take a look at the data. I think your context was very right at the very beginning of the program, 20 years from now. So people should not panic. I think the reports that are saying that having a COVID vaccination caused all of the problems we're seeing is probably mischaracterized a bit. And again, the influence of social media and short news cycles on information.
Dr. Giuliani, I've got to cut you short. I wanted the time to say thank you for coming on today. They're about to cut us off here. We're at the top of the hour.